Jurisdiction is the ability of a court to enter an enforceable order against someone. The ability of the court to order an enforceable order against someone. How did law begin? Way, way, way back. Middle Ages. The kings or the king's representatives would simply come to the community where the dispute was, hear the dispute, and decide what to do about it, who was going to win or not win. At some point, somebody said, particularly as years went on and books came along, maybe what we ought to do is start writing these decisions down. Because if we write these decisions down, then when we get a new dispute, we can say, it's been written, it's written. It's sort of like Scripture is written. Through religious belief, you follow Scripture, at least at that time. We can say that the legal principles are written down, and therefore we have to follow them, because they are in a book, and they are the law of the land. That way the king or the king's representative wouldn't have to take the heat from the party that lost the dispute. They say, you can't blame me, just blame the book, because that's what's written. So they start writing these things down. And these decisions, called legal precedent, follow the existing law on that subject, except that's not the way it's spelled. You never know that the man standing up here was the fourth grade spelling champion of the Macklin Harbor Mary School in Grand Rapids, Michigan. By misspelling the word precedence. I'll try not to do that either. And so these became law books. And this occurred for a long period of time and gradually evolved. By evolve, I mean new fact situations would come in, not known before, new decisions would be written down. The old decisions would change a little bit as time went on. And it evolved into what's called, and a lot of you should be familiar with this term, common law. Common law is judge-made law. It's in the law books, and we still have it today. In fact, most of the common law contracts, until we get to UCC, sale of goods by merchants, which is all statutory, by the way, the UCC is in the back of the book. We'll get back to that later. Until we get to that, it's all common law. So a lot of these rules that we're going to, when we get to contracts in a few weeks, are going to be rules that started way back in the Middle Ages when the king's representatives start writing down these decisions in the books. The United States Constitution, when it was adopted, said common law shall be preserved. Where it existed in England at the time of the adoption of the United States Constitution is preserved in the United States and not all 50 states, 49 states. Can anybody tell me the oddball state that doesn't have it? Let me give you a hint. Thomas Jefferson. Does that help anybody?
Delaware?
What about the Louisiana Purchase? Thomas Jefferson purchased Louisiana and some other territory and handed it to the United States. Louisiana was inhabited by French, and France never had English common law. France always had their little codes, their little statutory codes like we have today in our statutory codes. And so because Louisiana was uniquely French, Louisiana, no common law. But all the other 49 states do. So common law is judge-made law. Every time a judge makes a decision on a case, if it is a matter of state law, not a matter of United States constitutional law, it goes into a law book and it becomes part of this large body known as common law, large body of law. It's judge-made law and it's gap-filling law. What do I mean by that? Anytime a state legislature, a state, wishes to pass a statute on a particular subject of law, any common law on that same subject is eliminated when they do that. So when Michigan joined again, 48, not 49, other states, in passing the Uniform Commercial Code, which dealt just with contracts, sale of goods by merchants, and eliminated all the common law on those kind of contracts when they passed it. Another class I teach is criminal law, and we still have some criminal common law still left. The Michigan legislature never passed a law on the crime known as accessory after the fact of the felony. And so that common law, as it existed in England, punishable by the same 5 years as it was in England, is still good law in Michigan today. So gap-filling law is common law. So if the legislature chooses not to pass a statute on a particular subject, that doesn't mean there's no law on it. It means there might be law on it if you can find a case by a judge in a law book interpreting English common law. Any question about any of that so far?
What if that were later, what if the judge made a decision and 3 years later some other attorney came along and said, no, that's a bad judgment?
That happens all the time. Judges change judgment law all the time. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up, Mike, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up because our court in here, I'm going to give the authority to change common law if you don't like it. You can enact your own law to settle that case. It happens all the time. Okay, everybody understand common law pretty much?
So if a judge changes a law, which one is in force? The latest?
Right. The court has the authority to repeal its prior decision and change it and adapt a new rule on that subject. Say, modern day technology or modern day problems that didn't exist before, the old common law wasn't intended to cover that situation, or they can say the older case was wrongly decided. They do that a lot. We just think our decision, which was probably 20 or 30 years before with a whole bunch of different judges, they can say was wrongly decided and we change it.
So that keeps... So the appeal lawyers can go back 30 years and say, well, we just made this law, and grandfather clause figures in somewhere.
Well, yeah, legal precedent.
Okay.
Any decision that's not been overturned can be cited as legal precedent. I cited the other day some 19th century cases, a case that I was working on, because when I ran them on Westlaw, they were the most recent cases on that subject. And so until they get overturned, courts must follow established legal precedent unless they can figure out a way to be able to show the prior case was wrongly decided or just make up some other excuse. So actually there isn't really anything that controls judges. Yes, they're supposed to follow legal precedent, but it's like where the 500-pound gorilla wants to sleep, anywhere the hell he wants to. Judges have a lot of power, and if they can change something, they'll change it. They really want to do it. United States Supreme Court right now is probably one vote, maybe not even one vote anymore, away from changing Roe versus Wade. So monumental decisions can be changed. United States Supreme Court in 1896 decided that separate but equal schools for African Americans was okay and didn't violate the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Because just because they were separate doesn't mean they weren't equal, they said. Well, in 1954, Supreme Court says, no, that's all wrong. Separate school systems for African Americans and whites are inherently unequal. They violate the 14th Amendment. So, before World War II, there were two conflicting decisions on whether or not keeping Japanese Americans in concentration camps violated the Constitution. One court said one thing 1 year, and the next year they completely changed it. So, courts change decisions all the time. See if I can follow this. And Mike. Yeah, but which Mike? Mike Prime.
Yep.
There's another Mike in another corner spot. Okay. Down there. Okay. Taylor. Samantha. Anna and Nicole. And then we got Collins for Foxhill. Foxhill Collins. Collins Foxhill. Sorry. And then Joe Manee. the name? Amanda? Like, Colleen Duby Sheehan? I like that Irish part, Sheehan part. Mindy Etten and Stephanie. And back to Adam Detmer. And Nicholas, and Laura, it's like everybody did a hell of a job on this thing. Usually I have to have a student do this, class do this twice before I get it done right. Lindsay Severson. Severson. Like I said, Lindsay Severson. Sophia. So, Sophia?
Yeah.
Hey, I got that right. And Jason back there. Jacob?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's my fault. I was looking there. I was like, oh. Jason, okay. Jacob, Joe, Lucas, and then Lawrence, Emily, Katie, Mike. Good. All right, sources of law. Well, we already have one of them covered, kind of one. And we really already talked about another one, didn't we? Statutory. Statutes. Common law cover in Michigan, automobile negligence tort liability until such time as Michigan passed no-fault insurance law, which changed it, eliminated it, because that's what legislatures can do with statutes, eliminate the common law. There's another one that we're not going to spend a whole much time on, administrative. It's the law of administrative agencies. They can pass regulations and within their areas of jurisdiction. OSHA and Social Security and workers' compensation, all that kind of stuff. Administrative law. And then constitutional law. The supreme authority. Under the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, any attempt by a state, or even any attempt by Congress, to enact either a state law or a federal law that is in conflict with the provision of the United States Constitution is invalid, is null and void, because of Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. And we will deal with this a little bit as we go along. There are some things in contracts, torts, and other parts of law that we're going to cover that deal with the United States Constitution. Real estate law, for example, eminent domain, which is covered by the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which gives the government the right to steal your property, whether you like it or not, as long as they pay you a fair price and as long as you need your property for public use and public benefit. Is there another hand I missed back here somewhere? So we won't deal with this a whole lot. But it will, now and then, we'll have an issue with constitutional law. Okay, then I want to get to the court system, unless we have any questions about anything so far. I thought tonight we would go, because we're not going to take a break, because it's a shorter night, and I'd like to go to about 10 to 8. Is that okay with everybody? But you don't get a break.
Okay. Big game on tonight.
Can I cover the rest of the courts? In 40 minutes? See if I can do it. All right. Starting with the Michigan court system, federal court systems are very, very, very similar. We have a three-tiered system. Actually, that's right. These courts in Michigan make me cry quite a bit. No, that's not right. Three-tiered system. We have a trial court. We have an intermediate appellate court. It sits in three judge panels. And we have the Supremes. With Diana Ross. No, not really Supreme. Supreme Court. The original dispute goes to the trial court, and we're going to be talking in a few minutes here about which disputes go in which trial courts. If your dispute goes to trial court, you lose there, you have the right to go to the appellate court. If you lose there, you can ask for permission to go to the Supreme Court. How would you like to have a job like that? where you only have to work if you agree to work, and you only have to hear a case if you decide you want to hear the case. That's the way it is with the Michigan Supreme Court. The term for that is called granting leave. Granting leave to appeal, they'll hear it. I don't get my leave to appeal granted too often, but they apparently don't like my arguments too much. By the way, Governor Snyder just appointed a guy to the Supreme Court, a guy that I've, from the Court of Appeals, I've argued many cases in front of, a guy named Brian Zaro, hometown. Federal court, same three-tiered system. The only difference is Michigan Supreme Court has 7, the U.S. Supreme Court has 9. The 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States, didn't like the Supreme Court. He tried to pack it. They reduced a law to increase the number of the Supreme Court. Was unsuccessful in doing so. For the Michigan Supreme Court to grant leave, they need 3 votes. 1 less than is needed to decide the case. Because since there's 7, then of course it would take 4 for somebody to win, but it takes 3 to decide to hear the case. Granting leave to appeal is just saying, okay, we'll hear it. Other side, you file a brief too. They already got the 1 brief. Other side, you file a brief too, we're going to hear this. That's what granting leave to appeal means. So 3 Michigan Supreme Court justices have to agree to do that to hear the case. U.S., 4. 4 votes to hear it. Why? Because they got 9. 1 less than is necessary to decide the case. Okay, trial courts. Michigan. This is the original place where you bring your dispute. Workers' compensation had their own special court system. All the rules are different. And they only deal with this comp case, so we're not going to cover that in class. At the trial court level in Michigan, for every other type of case, either starts in the district court, the probate court, or the circuit court. The district court has 2 divisions, small claims and civil, general civil. Small claims up to $3,500. Cases go to small claims. If you're running a small business someday, that may be where you're going to go for your small accounts. The good thing about small claims is it goes fast. No lawyers, but no appeal either. You can't appeal a small claims decision. But what you can do in Michigan, if you are being sued in the small claims court and you want to be represented by a lawyer, you can remove. It's called a removal. You can have the small claims lawsuit filed against you removed to the general civil division so that you can be, not only so that you can be represented by a lawyer, but you might have a counter complaint of a whole lot more than $3,500, which a small claims court judge would not have the authority to hear. General civil jurisdiction goes up to $25,000. So no lawyers, $3,500 limit, no appeal. It's pretty informal. And I don't know that those judges here in those small claims cases always follow the law either. Lawyers are not in there to see what you're doing. But some of the judges that I know, I have to be careful. Get in trouble with their mouth sometimes. I'll give you my opinions about it. I'm a critic of the legal profession and the court system because I think things need to be done a certain way called the right way, and I don't like it when it isn't. And some of the things that happen locally I'm not too thrilled about, so I hope I'm not going to put my foot in my mouth too many times and get too many people in this community mad at me. Probate. Not probate just yet. need to digress a minute before we get to probate and certify. In the old days, for me, the old days would be up to the adoption of the Michigan Constitution, which was 1962. There were two different kinds of court systems, called legal courts and equity courts. This was a tradition inherited from England. And in equity courts, they weren't called judges, they were called chancellors. Equity courts dealt with anything that didn't involve money damages. You're in court, but it's not because you're suing somebody for money damages. That was equity. If you're suing somebody for money damages, so the old system went, you're in the legal court, and they're called judges. Michigan eliminated, with the Constitution of 62, eliminated this and put everything in circuit court. So what are all of these various kinds of actions which would start in circuit court that are equitable actions? Divorce cases, child custody cases, child support cases, cases in which you're trying to get an injunction against somebody, to keep somebody away from you, or to get somebody to stop violating your rights, or somebody, your neighbor, is contaminating your property, or he's encroaching on your boundary. And so you're trying to get a circuit judge to enter an order to order this person to stop doing something. Those are all equity types of cases. So all of those go to circuit court. Now there's some specialized areas in probate court we'll talk about in a minute here. I kind of skipped over probate for now because I wanted to talk more about circuit court first. Criminal cases involving felonies have to be tried in circuit court. They start in district court, but then they go to circuit court. So circuit court has law and equity. So circuit court has, and I'll try to keep the high end of the blackboard in use and not the low end, because some of you can see that. Almost all equity cases, felony criminal cases, and civil claims over $25,000, under $25,000 in district court. Personal protection order cases, although that comes from a Michigan statute that was enacted about 20 years ago, is all part of the court's equity jurisdiction. Why did I say almost all equity cases? Because the Michigan legislature took a couple equity cases, type of cases, and stuck them with the district court. And what are those? Landlord-tenant. Talking about the third part of the class. Land contract forfeiture cases. You've got a land contract with somebody and they defaulted and they're not making the payments and you want to get them out of the house. The circuit judges in the state of Michigan wanted the personal protection order cases to go to district court. Because circuit judges think they're too important to be dealing with personal protection order cases. I think that's more of a district judge's responsibility. Now, the legislature said no. Circuit judges deal with not only granting personal protection orders, but enforcing them as well when somebody makes a violation. Probate court deals with family issues other than divorce. Leave it to the Michigan legislature to muddy this up in half. wish they would have left them alone and made things simpler, but they won't do that. You said divorce was a circuit court, and it is. But the legislature said that, well, if the probate court is already involved with this family from some other issue, guardianship, abuse, neglect type matter, then somebody, a member of the family, wants to get a divorce. Since the probate court already has jurisdiction over that family, they can do the divorce too. So some divorces actually get heard by a probate judge. And then some counties really get ridiculous, like Tuscola and Aranac try to push all of the divorce cases to the probate judge just because the circuit judge doesn't want to do them. Mental health proceedings. And estates. Wills and estates. In the third section of the class, I hope to spend some time on wills and estates before we get done. Okay. This is all subject matter jurisdiction. When we say subject matter jurisdiction, we mean you're in the right court for the type of lawsuit or action that you have to bring. And that's what we just covered. There's another issue called personal jurisdiction. And in every case, there must be personal jurisdiction over the defendant that's being sued, as well as subject matter jurisdiction from that judge. Personal jurisdiction, again, is the ability of the court to be able to enter an enforceable order against that defendant. All of us that live in Michigan are subject to the jurisdiction of the Michigan courts. That's true. But we still have to be personally served with the summons and complaint for the court to have jurisdiction over us. Summons is, we got you. We're the court and we got you now, buddy. You got to do what we want you to do. Which means you got to file an answer to this complaint, or you have to show up to court when you're supposed to. There are consequences for those things when you don't do them. The complaint is the lawsuit. That's what is called cause of action against somebody. And that cause of action has to be recognized either from common law or from statute. Breach of contract, that's a cause of action. Invasion of privacy, that's torts. Negligence, that's torts. Unreasonably dangerous product sold in a defective condition, that's strict liability and tort under the UCC. So whatever your cause of action is, you have to lay that out in your complaint. Because the cause of action is made up of component parts. You have to prove each one of those to prove your case. And so you have to allege each one of those in the complaint. What are the component parts of a negligence action? Duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, and damages. This is all going to be emblazoned in your heads by the time you get down to the court.
Can you write those down?
That's what has to be proven for a negligence and tort lawsuit.
Can you write those down under that?
When we get to torts, I will. I'm just giving an example.
Alright.
You don't need to know that now. I just want to start with, take it slow here. We're just starting with basic lawsuits. So the lawsuit needs the component parts of your cause of action. When I say needs, you must allege them. Allege them to be true. You need jurisdiction. You have to allege that. And you need venue. So with jurisdiction, you have to allege that you're in the right court in your lawsuit. In venue. That means you're filed in the right county. The proper county is... You won't need to know this for the test, but the proper county is the county in which either the defendant resides or the cause of action arose. Breach of contract action arose where the contract was entered into. The tort action arose where the person was injured. So it can be filed in either one of those two situations. You've got proper venue. So you lay out your elements of your cause of action, your component parts, you allege those things to be true. You establish that you're in the right court. You establish that you're in the right county. And you've got a proper civil complaint in Michigan. Any question about this so far?
Random question, but like, say like if I go and do like all that and I go to the wrong court, would they tell me I'm in the wrong court, or would it just like go through everything?
They might, but they're not supposed to, because they're not supposed to give you legal advice. Only a lawyer that's licensed by the state of Michigan can give legal advice.
So like,
so some clerks will and some won't. It just depends where you are. I know in Midland they probably will. Dangerous. And if you're working at a court, I wouldn't do it. It's dangerous because you don't want somebody coming back and bringing your name up and saying, this person told me this is what I should do, and they work for a court.
You know, well, the reason why I ask that is because, like, if you, like, somebody that has no idea what they're doing, and this
that's why you go to a lawyer.
Do something.
They don't care if you know what you're doing.
Probably not. Some do. Every once in a while, you find one that's pretty helpful. Okay. So how does the court obtain personal jurisdiction over this person through the summons and complaint? Personal service. Can anybody demonstrate on that on me on what would constitute personal service with this piece of paper, this class list? Come on, you can do it. Do it.
You've been served.
Nope, do it. Do it. Haven't done it yet. He just did it. Touches the body. That's what does it. So if the person does not accept it in the hand and they let it blow away, the person's been served. Of course, the person that did that, Mike, has to sign a sworn affidavit called a proof of service, indicating at a certain date and time and at a certain location, he physically handed a summons and complaint to the defendant. That's all you have to say. You don't have to say he accepted it or he didn't accept it. He decided not to accept it, that's his problem, and I only have to touch his body.
No, what if you're not at your residence, and they go to your residence, and they say they have proof of service, they sign that sworn affidavit statement. Now,
okay, that's not valid service. However, Michigan does have a procedure whereby you can go to the judge if the judge will sign an order to let you do it. It's called an order of substitute service. But you have to make a showing that you're not able to personally serve this person because they got rabbit legs and you don't. You can't catch up to them. You've made all kinds of attempts. And you can't get close to them and they keep running away. And judge, will you please let me tack this on his door? Will you please let me put this inside of his door? If the judge says yes, you can do it. It's called an order of substitute service. If it's for a different reason, you can't find the person. You don't even necessarily know where the person is anymore. And you, again, have to set forth a petition requesting that the judge allow you an order of substitute service for publication in a newspaper. Now, this is one of these times where we deal with the United States Constitution. And we're talking about procedural due process of law under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Adequate notice before governmental sanctions can be levied against you. We're kind of touching this area now. That's why the judge has to make a finding that the means with which the person was given notice of the lawsuit satisfies notions of procedural due process requirements under the United States Constitution. Lawrence.
Well, like, in every other single business class I've taken so far, every single teacher said the same thing. Newspapers are becoming obsolete. So, like, do they still do that nowadays, even though newspapers are obsolete? Because I don't think I've read a newspaper.
No, not true at all.
In, like, 5 years of my life.
Not true at all. Okay, so this order of substitute service, you say, and you have to set forth all of the efforts that you made to try to serve this person and still weren't, or all the efforts made to try to find this person and still were not able to find them. Judge, let me advertise in a newspaper of general circulation in the community where I last knew this person had an address. The judge will let you do that. And so you read the Midland Daily News tonight when you get home in the classified section. You're going to see some of those orders to answer. It's called an order to answer. you fictional person out there who's probably not reading this newspaper, you are ordered to answer the lawsuit by a certain date that's right in that advertisement. And so that's been held to satisfy procedural due process requirements of the Fifth Amendment. Newspaper publication in a newspaper general circulation. Now, it really gets ridiculous in Bay City. Right, practice. They have a newspaper called the Bay City Democrat. That's not a newspaper general circulation. How many people do you know in Bay City? Anybody from Bay City here? Reads the Bay City Democrat. I'm not knocking the Bay City Democrat.
I don't know who it is.
But it's not a paper general circulation, but the judges all accept that there. Probably to keep that newspaper alive, but
full of them.
What's that?
And it's full of them.
Yeah. But it's ridiculous because that, to me, doesn't accord with notions of procedural due process. That's not reasonably calculated to reach the person that it was intended to reach, which is the standard, legal standard that's involved. So you need both personal and subject matter jurisdiction, and you can proceed with your lawsuit. Well, the lawsuit gets served, personally served. What if our defendant does nothing about it? Default. Default judgment. Who ruled on this in Michigan? 21 days for personal service. Oh, what substitutes for personal service is restricted mail delivery. If our defendant signed that green card, not some other bozo that answered the door, which can happen for certified mail, restricted mail delivery. So if you're trying to sue somebody and you think that they'll probably sign that card when the postman brings it to the door, that's fine, but it can't be certified because the postman's going to let anybody sign for it. It's got to be restricted delivery. You can get that. And that person that signs that card to get that envelope, I know over the years there was a few guys on divorce cases that was having a hard time serving. So we sent it in an envelope and we put Corvette manual on the envelope. And those guys, they signed for that envelope thinking they were getting the Corvette manual. And they got the summons and complaint instead. Somebody have a hand up over here?
Are we in the probate court?
No. We cover probate court, all we're going to cover it. Mental health issues, adoptions, family issues, guardianships, abuse, neglect matters are all under this.
So you
sent
that in there and say Corvette magazine. Did you actually put Corvette magazine in there?
No.
Now is that like a form of like entrapment?
Nope. Because the only purpose of the rule is to get this person notice of the proceedings against them. And if they're not in service, I don't feel sorry for them, nor does the judge. I'm actually doing them a favor, because if I advertised in a newspaper, he probably wouldn't read the paper, and that would be worse. The lawsuit would continue against him, and he wouldn't even know about it. At least this way, they got a chance to defend it. Somebody else have a hand up here? Okay. So 21 days after personal service or 21 days after restricted delivery service. And again, that green card that the guy signs on restricted service, that becomes the proof of service. So all you got to do is just attach that to your proof of service, file it with the court, and that person's been served.
If the person, like, say, sorry to go back, but if you go put it in the newspaper and the person doesn't read it, does a bench warrant ever go out for his arrest, or if he never ever responds to it, or no?
No, that's later when we're going to talk about enforcing judgments. That's when the bench warrants happen.
All right.
Okay. We're right now we're just starting with the beginning of the lawsuit. Okay. What if they still don't file an answer? Now the answer has to be I admit or deny the allegations in the complaint. Again, the allegations in the complaint are the component parts of the cause of action, establishing jurisdiction, and venue. Okay. The person does not file an answer. Plaintiff can file a default. Default says, Judge, this person has failed to file an answer to the complaint within the time allowed by the court rules, so I'm entitled to a judgment. In other words, plaintiff's entitled to win, which is the purpose of the lawsuit, is to get that judgment. Money judgment or whatever other kind of judgment. Divorce case judgment. we get some interesting results, like a paternity lawsuit, where the guy just doesn't do anything, and there's a default judgment that says he's the daddy, and he says, I ain't the daddy. I was in Africa at the time, or I was in Afghanistan, or Iraq, or in the military. The military is not a good example, because you can't default somebody in the military. The person says, I was working overseas, maybe as a contractor in Iraq. I couldn't have been the daddy. Yeah, but you are now, because once a judgment's entered, you're the daddy for all of time. You can't screw around with legal papers. You can't. And that's an important issue, because it's important to the child that the issue of parentage be decided quickly and not left dangling out there until this guy decides he wants to do something about the lawsuit. Lots of these guys come along and say, well, I want to have the DNA test because I can show that I'm not the daddy. Buddy, you've been defaulted and a judgment was entered against you. Defaulting is a two-tiered process. This is the first thing. You file a default saying there was no answer. File within time limit. What's the second thing you have to allege? I just hinted it a minute ago. Anybody here been in the military? Our defendant is not presently a member of the United States military. You have to allege that too. Because you can't, the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act protects active duty military people from getting default judgments against them. You cannot default somebody in the military. If you want to divorce somebody that's in the military, if you don't got no proof of service, you ain't getting a divorce. And even if you do have a proof of service, if he doesn't file an answer, he ain't getting a divorce until he gets out, because he's got that protection. So the first tier is, you file the notice of default alleging he's not in the military, and he didn't file an answer on time. That's the first thing. So the first thing, file default. The second thing, you got to wait 21 days to see if our defendant is going to file a motion to set aside the default. A motion is when you file a written document asking for some relief from the court. You're asking the judge to do something for you. That's a motion. So our defaulted defendant has 21 days to file a motion to set this default aside so he can get back into the lawsuit. But he's got to allege one of two things. In fact, he has to allege both of them, not one of them. Both of them. I got a meritorious defense. Ten more minutes to finish this. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I got a meritorious defense. In other words, just if I didn't get defaulted, I'd likely win the lawsuit, and here's why. He's suing me for breach of contract, Judge, from a contract 6 years ago, and the statute of limitations for breach of contract is only 6 years. Well, I would win. So you never have that, but you never have to worry about that in a divorce case, because in a divorce case, there's nobody who wins or loses. That's a subjective thing. And so, for the divorce case, they waive that part of the requirement. But not in a money damage case. You got to show I likely would win. That's the first thing. The second thing is excusable neglect. You got to come up with an excuse good enough that judge is going to be satisfied. Judge, I was sick. I was in the hospital. My mother, I'm the only child, and my mother suddenly took ill and bored, and there was nobody to take care of her, and I had to get on a plane and go down to Florida, and I was there for 2 or 3 weeks. Or Mr. Dunn is busy, and he teaches at Delta, and I had a hard time getting in. I just couldn't. And then Mr. Dunn got sick, and then I got sick, and then the 21 days was used up, Judge, and I just couldn't. I did everything I could. I was working 70 hours a week at my job, and three other guys got laid off, and I was doing their job. If the judge thinks the excuse is good enough, you'll find excusable neglect. And most judges have the attitude, particularly when a lawyer comes on behalf of the defendant. If it's a close call, they'll set it aside and let that lawyer represent that defendant and get that defendant to stay. Some judges take a hard-nosed approach to this, but most don't. Most are fairly flexible. But the person comes in without a lawyer, not as flexible. Any questions about that so far?
That was the only two ways they'll waive, the 21-day or the 28-day?
Yes. Well, you got to show both. You got to show meritorious defense and excusable neglect. And unless it's a divorce case, the which case you only have to show, I'd say divorce or divorce related, like child custody and child support. Other than those matters, you have to show meritorious defense and excusable neglect. Okay, so you get past default stage, you're in the discovery stage of the lawsuit. Discovery stage means that each side's trying to find out information about the other side's case. Each side's trying to put the other one in the hole. You don't really have these issues in small claims cases. This is very informal. You just bring all the documents you have to court, and they bring all the stuff they have to court, and the judge just looks at it all, and nobody cares about discovery. So you want to pin the other side down. You want to make them say what they, show what they've got, and you want to hurt them. You want to damage them before the case gets to trial. Bring out the weak point. So discovery, finding information about your opponent, can be done through written questions, depositions, or requests to produce documents. Questions, interrogatories, or request to admit. I like request to admit. They're my favorite. Request to admit. I'm entitled to either a yes or no answer. Please admit that you actually drank in three other bars other than the bar you're suing now just before the accident. Please admit that you've been convicted for entering and publishing checks and fraud. Please admit that you told Jones that you were in a different bar other than this bar that you're now suing. They can't weasel out. They have to admit or not admit. So I'm asking that because I think I'm going to get the answer I want because I think I've got evidence that establishes that answer. So that person now has a choice, either helping me in the case and hurting their case or lying under oath. That's a good spot to put your opponent in, one or the other. Depositions, a court recorder, you get, and the good thing about depositions is, you get to ask follow-up questions. Because interrogatories are just questions. Now, they may not answer those questions very well. But depositions, you can ask follow-up questions and really kind of turn the heat up on this person. And, of course, depositions are recorded, and you've got something to use against them during the trial. I can tell you from practicing law and trying cases for 28 years, witnesses seldom say the same thing twice. They just don't. That's just what human beings are. Something's different. And you catch them in that, you damage their credibility before the jury. Okay. There can be some motions filed, too. Motion to summary judgment. This person didn't state a cause of action. This person cannot recover. This action is barred by the statute of limitations. Those kind of things. Two. After that, we get to case evaluation. Judge wants to put heat on the lawyers and the parties to settle that case because the judges don't want to try too many cases. They don't think they have time to try very many cases. So they feel most of them should be settled. And so they want the lawyers to squeeze their clients. Case evaluation is usually with three lawyers sitting at the panel evaluating the case, listening to the claims of each of the parties, and they do written briefs. And they make a recommendation as to whether the defendant should pay or not pay. Sometimes what they try to do is compromise and try to bring the parties together. It's non-binding. Either side can accept or reject the result of this case evaluation panel. Don't really have these. We used to have these in divorce cases. In Bay County, Midland County doesn't use case evaluation for divorce cases. Once it gets past that, then you might have an arm twisting session in court called a final settlement conference where the judge likes to twist. Every judge is different. It depends on how that judge wants to do it. I'm talking circuit judges now. And so that circuit judge, some circuit judges will do everything they can to get the case settled. They'll twist arms and they'll twist them so hard they'll break the arms of lawyers. Some judges don't do that at all. It just depends on the judge. The only thing that's left after that, if we still don't settle the case, is trial. It can be by a judge or by a jury. In Michigan, it's 6 jurors for civil cases. Not 12, 6. And you can have a verdict with a non-unanimous jury, unlike a criminal case. So actually, by majority, you can have a 4-2 verdict. When the defendant wins, plaintiff loses. That's called a verdict of no cause of action. Or sometimes referred to as a no cause. When the plaintiff wins, it'll be judgment for plaintiff in the amount of X amount of dollars, whatever the jury thinks. Now back to that equity law distinction again. Equity cases, no jury. Equity cases always heard by only a judge. Legal cases involving money damages can be either. Well, plaintiff almost always wants a jury. They don't want a judge to decide the case. Plaintiff lawyers like especially in tort cases, like to play up sympathy and everything, and so they want jurors. They definitely want women on the jury. That's just the way they are. So it's rare in a tort case for the plaintiff to weigh a jury and have one judge decide the case. But you can. And if neither side demands a jury in a civil case, the judge will decide it. So you have to demand a jury in addition to that court filing fee. You have to pay a jury fee to get the jury. Never an equity case. So if it's adverse possession case, borderline encroachment, contamination of property, personal protection, owner divorce, custody, anything where the purpose in being in court is not to obtain money damages. Equity cases, always heard by a judge. Money damage cases or called law cases, jury is demanded. What is the standard of proof? It is used to decide the case. The judge will instruct the jury that you must use this standard of proof to decide the case. In the civil case, it's majority of the evidence. Which side convinced you more? Did the plaintiff convince you more? Did the defendant convince you more? Now the actual legal term is called preponderance. And because I want you to understand the concept here, I'm telling you majority, because I think everybody understands what majority is. Now, criminal cases, not the same standard of proof. In criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a much higher standard of proof. So even though you think maybe the plaintiff presented a stronger case than the defendant, you still have some doubts in your mind that are based on reason and common sense as to which you look. If that's the case, then the defendant wins. If there's any man in the United States of America right now that knows the difference between the preponderance of the evidence standard for civil cases and the guilt beyond a reasonable doubt standard for criminal cases, who would that man be?
O.J.
Simpson. Because O.J. Simpson went to a criminal trial first and was found not guilty, which means not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Then he went to a civil trial, and a civil jury found by the lesser preponderance of the evidence or majority of the evidence standard, they found that he did kill those people. Somebody else have a hand, or am I just seeing things? What's our hand over here? Now back to where we started. You lose at the trial level, you're going to have an automatic right of appeal to the next higher court. If you have a consent judgment, consent meaning both sides settled and they agree on a judgment, you have no right to appeal because you settled. Did I do it? I did it. I got done.
Good job.
Is that all the information? I think that's all I wanted to give you tonight. Next week we're going to dive into court law. Chapter 9, a whole lot more than Chapter 9, even if you're waiting for the rest of it. Oh, the problems, we can see the problems after Chapter 9.